What are some of the things that we've learned about these diseases in the last few years that you think is important to know about?
As we think about the myeloproliferative disorders, really the way that we think about these conditions has changed dramatically in the last decade. In fact, they even changed their name. They're not myeloproliferative disorders anymore. They're now myeloproliferative neoplasms. This year, for example, we've seen some really important changes in the basic way in which we diagnose these patients with an update in the WHO diagnostic criteria. These are really important because they focus a lot on the interfaces between these diseases. In my view, and in the view of the WHO, it's not really good enough to say this patient has a JAK2 positive MPN. You really have to work hard to make an accurate diagnosis for your patient. So the new WHO diagnostic criteria really focus on the interfaces. So the interface, for example, between ET and PV, especially for a patient with a JAK2 positive disease. So really thinking about when should you be thinking about, golly, does this patient really have PV? Is this hematocrit too high for a patient with ET? And at the other end, the interface between ET that's really not ET, that's really an early stage of myelofibrosis. So the WHO have now included this entity called prefibrotic myelofibrosis, where the patients can often get confused with a patient with ET. And of course, these can be patients with the JAK2 mutation or with one of the newer mutations we've learned to apply to testing for our patients. So here I'm thinking about calreticulin mutations that are present in around 30% or so of patients, or the rarer MPL mutations. So in defining this new entity, the WHO is really making us think about what's not typical for an ET patient. Because when we see an ET patient, we really put them almost, we're just thinking about preventing clotting. We're not thinking too much about progression here. So if we saw, for example, a patient with a raised white cell count, more than 11,000, splenomegaly, a raised LDH, for example, this is where the WHO is saying, stop and think. This patient may not be as straightforward as you think. So they've really tried to sharpen our resolution. Another thing that I think is important in clinical practice is the focus on the patients that have so-called triple negative disease. So these are the patients that lack the three driver mutations. That accounts for, say, 10 to 15% of ET or myelofibrosis patients and very, very few PV patients. So what the WHO is now saying is, think very carefully about another diagnosis. And these are the patients where you might think, for example, about doing an extended mutation testing. So you're looking for mutations, for example, in other myeloid-associated genes. The ones I have in mind particularly would be ASXL1, EZH2, IDH1 and 2. Now, these might not particularly help you in saying this is myelofibrosis, but they're helping you in saying this patient's got a clonal myeloid disorder. So there are many changes starting right from the way we diagnose the patients through to the way that we then manage them, and many new drugs on the horizon that we have to think about in clinical practice.
So a really basic question, when you kind of conceptualize this disease or set of diseases, I assume that you visualize this as a cancer. What's the primary cell of origin of the cancer, and how do you explain how that affects the phenotype?
So with the change to the term neoplasm, we've been focusing more on these diseases as a type of cancer and thinking about what does that mean? Where is the mutation arising? Questions about how does one mutation, in particular the JAK2V617F mutation, give rise to the three different diseases? And these are things that we've been really thinking about very much in recent times. I wouldn't say right now that we have the answer, but what I would say is that it seems that things are more complicated than we first thought. It's quite apparent now that you can find the JAK2V617F mutation, for example, in some of the lymphoid cells for patients with myelofibrosis. In Serge Verstovsek recently published, you can find it in the fibroblasts and the marrow. So that really challenges our conception of fibrosis being reactive. And in some patients, the JAK2V617F mutation has been identified in the endothelial cells, perhaps explaining why some of these patients get atypical thromboses. I'm thinking particularly of thromboses in the splanchnic bed. So as I think about it, I wouldn't say I have the answer, but as I think about it, I think in the patients with myelofibrosis, often these probably are patients where the mutation may well be arising in a more primitive cell, perhaps. And in patients who've got more of the phenotype of ET, this is just conjecture, this is not fact, that maybe the mutation is arising in a more committed cell, so we don't see involvement of other lineages. But also perhaps there are other factors, other single nucleotide polymorphisms or other factors in that patient's genetic makeup that mean that they're more likely to have the phenotype of ET than MF or indeed PV.